Okay, May, do you have any further comment on that paragraph? Or?
No, we'll move along because we have to. We have a lot to cover today.
Okay. Latimer was also allowed to see other items that have been shown only to a few persons but have not been absolutely denied to non-governmental experts. These included the president's bloody and bullet-punctured clothing, the sole bullet, which was found after the shooting, and the president's back brace.
Now, Dr. Latimer, in order to extend the article and make you feel convinced that this was a thorough investigation, they said he examined the clothing and the bullet. Dr. Latimer isn't qualified to examine the x-rays. He is not a ballistic man. Seeing bullet 399 doesn't mean anything. Seeing the clothing of John Kennedy does not tell him about exit or entry fibers at all. Just because they showed him these things and he passed through does not make him an authority, but the article is padded to make it look like he really was in the archives doing work that day.
It seems like the only thing he didn't examine was anything that had to do with his specialty of urology.
Which was John Kennedy's urine, yeah.
Yeah, and his kidneys, maybe.
Yeah.
Okay, let's see. One final item, which was mentioned only in passing during the hearing conducted by the former Chief Justice Earl Warren and other members of the commission, gives a revealing insight into the discomfort that Kennedy suffered as a result of his wartime back injury. The item is a knitted elastic ACE bandage. Those are familiar to most of us, the elastic bandages.
Yes.
Latimer says he has learned from physicians who gave emergency treatment to the president that he wore this bandage in a tightly wrapped figure eight through his crotch and around the back of his buttocks. Its purpose was to help immobilize his lower spine, but Latimer said it could also have helped keep him upright after he was hit by the first bullet, so that he was exposed to the second bullet.
You see, the reason to go into that back brace in that relationship is that the Zapruder films are very controversial, and they show that when John Kennedy was hit from the back, he went into one position, and when the fatal bullet hit him, his head was thrown back, and it showed the location where the gunman would be according to the way he responded to the accident, and his brain matter went in back of him, not in front. This particular doctor who's speaking for the government is not qualified to talk about the law of physics, so he takes a simple thing like an ACE bandage that goes, wraps all around the president and tries to explain why his posture was upright, you know, to hold him in that position. When a bullet like that hits this man, he's gone, and he will go the way the apple falls off the tree. And I don't care what kind of brace the apple's wearing, it's going to fall down. So he went into great length about the brace, which again shows that they had to cover the Zapruder films and the trajectory, and he's overdoing it and padding it.
But how does an ACE bandage around your crotch cause a piece of the skull and the brain to fly out the back of the head, which I've seen the Zapruder film, Harv Morgan at one of the radio stations in San Francisco.
Yeah, I have a copy.
And I looked at it frame by frame, and you can actually see a fragment come out the back of the head.
Well, the way it happens is this. If you're speaking for the government, it happens that way. That's all. That's the story, and that's the way it stands. And the law of government's as good as the law of physics these days. It's pretty tight. It holds that's the way John Kennedy responded to a bullet. The commission says he responded a certain way, and it's against the law of physics, so they send in this particular lackey to say it happened. His posture was determined by his brace. The Warren Commission even tries to explain the distance of the holes in his shirt and coat to the wounds in his body by saying he's probably slumped over and his shirt was all messed up, and that is highly believable of John Kennedy. Then he goes on, the best part is that Latimer is a student of firearms.
Move on down. Latimer, 57, they're giving his age, is chairman of the Department of Urology of Columbia University's College of Physicians and Surgeons. He became a student of assassinations by firearms after he observed numerous wounds as an Army doctor during World War II.
They throw in the Army, you see. Here's the tie-in of Latimer to the defense of the Warren Commission. He probably still is in the reserves or some position like that. He is a urologist, and I know that the urologist takes care of the kidneys and the urine, and the reading of the x-rays is not his department of ballistics and
well,
so
this
forth.
Is kind of a hobby thing with him.
This is a hobby thing. He's a student of assassinations and firearms, and he is studying.
Well, he became a student of firearms through his hobby of the assassinations, because later in the paragraph,
it says he studied a series of articles. He's written a series of articles in medical journals describing the experiments he has conducted with rifles and scopes and ammunition similar to those used by Oswald.
Similar.
Well, that is really funny. I would love to see the articles he wrote. I'd like to see the weapons he's used and the ammunition he's used. I have a friend who is in charge of...
First, let me tell you what Latimer said. Let me read that, and then you read this letter.
Oh, yeah.
This is what Latimer's findings were. His finding that a round from such a weapon would penetrate 47 inches of pine wood reinforces the Warren Commission's theory that the same bullet passed through the president and seriously wounded former Governor John Connally of Texas, who was riding in the car's front seat.
Now, how can you put that together? What does that mean? The experiment. Just explain, you know, what conclusions he's coming to about putting it in a piece of wood, that it would prove it went through Kennedy and John Connally.
Now, you have some expert testimony of your own here.
Oh, yes. This comes from the Arms and Ammunition Department of Outdoor Life, and it was a letter written in 1951 to a gentleman who lives in Carmel Valley. He saved it because he is active in the rifle club in Carmel Valley, and
he had one of those rifles, one of those
Italian rifles. Well, he requested one. He has a hobby of collecting rifles, and he shoots well, and at one time in his life, he wrote a letter to the Arms and Ammunition Department in New York City of Outdoor Life, and he requested this kind of a rifle. And after the assassination, and we became friends, and he knew I was doing research, he looked in his files and found a copy of his letter. And this is the letter he got. Dear Mister, I'll leave this blank. The rifle is an Italian Mannlicher Carcano. That rifle, the Italian Mannlicher Carcano Army rifle, that you want. I'm afraid there isn't much you can do with it except to hang it on the wall as a war souvenir. Those rifles are made in two calibers, the 6.5mm and the newer 7.35mm. Neither cartridge is made in the United States and never will be. No ammunition in 6.5mm of any sort is made here. The 6.5 has a bore diameter of about 0.256 as against the bore diameter of 0.25 for the American rifle. Even the 6.5 Austrian Mannlicher Carcano has been discontinued. The 7.35 Mannlicher Carcano is even more of an odd baby. The Mannlicher Carcano action is not suitable for rebarreling. The action is not very strong. Often the materials are none too good, and it has a bad fault of design in that a pierced primer can blow the firing pin out of the bolt and back into the shooter's face. And all in all, those Italian Army rifles are excellent rifles, not to shoot, signed by Jack O'Connor of the Arms and Ammunition Department. So this is an expert on ammunition advising the usefulness and the availability of bullets and so forth of that gun. So it would be very interesting for the government now, who has allowed this particular urologist from Columbia University to go into the National Archives to publish in Sports World or some of the magazines his experiments on that rifle.
This doesn't sound like the kind of rifle. If I knew anything at all about rifles, I don't think I would choose this particular rifle if I were going to commit murder, or certainly not if I were going to assassinate the President of the United
States.
Well,
this so-called expert and writer on the subject needs to be challenged. I think we have to, in addition to pointing out problems in our society today that are important and affect our lives, we have to each week and all the time suggest alternatives. And I think you people should write to Senator Ted Kennedy now out there, and not only because he's a candidate for the presidency, or maybe a candidate, he hasn't declared yet, but you should write to him as a senator and as the member of the Kennedy family, surviving member, has the conditions on the archives, and say you're waiting for ballistic experts and qualified experts and researchers to get into the National Archives now, that we don't want it tied with elections or deals made behind our backs that affect our lives.
Yeah, the people responsible for the shock and jive and all the smoke screen and everything, they'll hear about this challenge, because it's almost a certainty that May's programs are monitored and taped and are listened to by, quote, authorities, unquote. But they already know it's shuck and jive.
Well, they
what
know.
Your responsibility is to contact your representatives and get them to work in your behalf to get the archives open to qualified experts who don't have anything to prove, just want facts.
That's right. You see, so many young people that listen to your station are talking now about elections and what should they do, what kind of program should they put in, how can they become educated, and what's happening in our system. And I say that if you look at the public officials who run your lives now, Ronald Reagan or Richard Nixon or Spiro Agnew, stop laughing at them and know that they're a reflection of yourself or your family, your parents, and this is what you all want. And if you don't want it, you ask some questions and you write to Senator Ted Kennedy and say, we want people to go in and examine those archives and those documents, because if there was a conspiracy to kill John Kennedy, then the government was overthrown, and maybe we can get 1972 back. We've got 42 weeks to get it on its right course. That's not very long.
Yeah, and you might say, well, what good would that do? The murders are all over and all that sort of thing. Well, number one, you would find out who actually did commit the murder if you're interested in justice. That's one point. Another point would be that if May's assertions are anywhere near correct, if there's even a reasonable doubt in your mind about this, then our government was overthrown in 1963, and these people have to be discredited. They have to be smoked out.
Yeah, well, one of the things that's so important that people just have to learn to have, Bob, is discipline to read. To read material, read facts, read articles such as this. You know, the movie in town this week, Milhouse, showed, and it's called Milhouse, A White Comedy. And I briefly mentioned last week, the joke is on us. I don't know why it's called a comedy. I call it closer to a tragedy. And we'll go right to that because it has to do with what's in the National Archives and how Richard Nixon became president.
Well, there's one final paragraph here in this article, and we'll wrap it up because I want to be sure we've covered every word of this article in case anyone accuses us of skipping anything.
Oh, no, we didn't.
Under the contract between the Archives and the Kennedy family, only recognized experts in the field of pathology or related areas of science or technology may see the items, now that an initial 5-year prohibition has passed. These restrictions will continue so long as any of the late president's immediate family live.
Yeah, well, we'll just make a brief comment on that. The family held these undeveloped x-rays for 2 years. They held the conditions under which they could not be seen for 5 years. Those conditions are left. Now, if a specialist comes in who's recognized, he may get into the archives. I do not think that this Dr. Latimer, as a urologist, is a recognized man in reading x-rays, and he certainly shouldn't have an opinion about who shot those bullets. That shows that his medical work is passed over. Any medical opinion he has is a political opinion because he's making a political statement about the passing of power in the United States. If he were a doctor, a qualified expert, he'd stick to what he saw in that body. And if an expert like that, that the government selects is in, it's, to see those x-rays, it's just a matter of time now till real experts get in.
Yeah, what we need now is for some internationally known expert whose reputation cannot be questioned, whose expertise cannot be questioned, to come forward publicly and say, I want to look at them.
Yeah, well, there was a doctor that came from Vienna.
A ballistics expert and an x-ray expert, you know.
The doctor came from Vienna to examine the body of Judge Haley up in Marin County, and that will change the whole course of the shootout or the trial of Rochelle McGee. The body was exhumed. The man is an expert in his field, and because he was called in and because Rochelle McGee is defending himself and doing a lot of the research on his own defense and knows what he did or didn't do, he's not afraid to ask an expert to come. And the man came from Vienna, and as the trial goes on, it'll change the course of that trial. And this is what we need with the John Kennedy murder. We can't be afraid to change our course.
And quite possibly someone listening right now knows of someone or knows someone who has such a reputation and could be very helpful along that line.
Oh, there's a lot of people who would be helpful. It's a question of getting the people, the listening audience, and the people at large outside to effect changes. The people who committed the crime aren't going to change the conclusions. You out there have to want to know the answers.
That's what I say. And, they're aware of what May is saying, and they're aware of how much of the press releases are shuck and jive and all that. So it's a waste of breath
to write to them anymore. I've written them so many letters, and you just have to get in your head and have groups who listen to the show and take notes of books and write to the Ted Kennedy family and as a senator and say, this is what we're being told about going into the National Archives. Now open it up and let everyone who's qualified see it.
Okay, May, we have approximately 15 minutes or so.
That's not very long. I wanted to, we spent so much time in that article. I did want to talk about Milhouse, and I brought it up because in studying the evidence of the murder of John Kennedy, there was so much evidence to solve that murder that was physically destroyed, and some that was planted, and some that was locked up, that I became aware of how much the government does destroy evidence or plant evidence on other people in order to effect a change. And last week we talked about that book, Inspection for Disarmament. A professor from the University of Heidelberg by the name of Gumbel was a pacifist, and after World War I, he exposed the illegal rearmament of Germany and the terrorism and the killing, the political murder of people in the German community in order to rearm and put Hitler into power after World War I. This particular man was wanted, tried three times for treason, and he left and went to France and then to the United States, where he teaches at Columbia University. And he charted the course of the buildup of World War I. And as I was watching the movie Milhouse the other day, expecting it to be funny, and as I say, it wasn't. You begin by laughing. It's done very well, and it's seems like a far-out comedy until it gets deeper into the thing, and you become aware that, as I said before, the joke is on us. And in going through the history of Richard Nixon's life, the one thing, the pinnacle, the one thing that made him become President of the United States was his constantly hammering away at what he said were communists. And that appealed to the people in power and the people that were nervous after World War II. When we ended up with allies with Russia, there were many people in the military and the defense industry who were used to a warfare state and didn't want to coexist with the Soviet Union or with China as it was becoming, it was a communist country. And Richard Nixon rode on the skirt of communism with his campaign against Voorhees. Mr. Voorhees talks in this thing about how he smeared him as being a communist when he really wasn't, or Helen Douglas smearing her. And then the famous case that made Richard Nixon really president, and he attributes to that, was the Alger Hiss case.
Yes.
And a lot of people are not familiar with the Alger Hiss case. We really should do just one show on it. But I want to make a point that in this movie, a man's name was mentioned that Richard Nixon refers to in his book, My Six Crises, but is not identified who the particular man is. And in the movie, they mention his name is Frank Perry. And Richard Nixon was called by a Frank Perry when he was still back east, not discharged from the service, and said, would you like to run for Congress against Mr. Voorhees?
This was the beginning of Nixon's political career.
This was the beginning of Nixon's political
career. Well, who is this Frank Perry who encouraged him?
With a little research and with seeing the movie Milhouse, a man is on the screen who says that he's Mr. Perry, the son of Frank Perry, who was vice president of the Bank of America. The vice president of the Bank of America. So I began to read a book on Nixon, which I've read before, but not in the same light. It's by Ralph De Toledano. It's a biography of Nixon. It's a pro-Nixon biography. And it tells how Nixon went into service in 1942. He was assigned to the South Pacific Combat Air Transport Command. And when the war was over, he went to Alameda, assigned on special orders to the Navy Bureau of Aeronautics, and ended up in New York, where he was assigned the position of winding up active contracts with aircraft firms. Now, historically, the aircraft industry was just beginning to grow. It didn't wind down. And Richard Nixon was back east in New York, in quotes, winding down air contracts and aerospace contracts. And the people who would be banking a Bank of America, like Douglas and Lockheed, the contracts coming from California were not going to do well if the aerospace contracts were wound down. And Richard Nixon was still in the service, in quotes, winding down aerospace contracts when the vice president of the Bank of America said, do you want to run for Congress? Now, you'd have to study, which I have done, the beginning of the aerospace industry and the rise of the aerospace and the bringing in to this country from Nazi Germany the top officials from von Braun on down who began to own ammunition and aircraft industries in the Southwest at the time that Nixon, of course, was winding down. But the interesting thing to me, as I read another book on Richard Nixon, was that a man named Alger Hiss was working in Washington, in the State Department, in 1934, examining rearmament, German rearmament. And this was the period where the Nazis, the new Nazis, were rearming illegally. And Alger Hiss was working in the State Department, in the Department of Examining Rearmament. And the man who removed Alger Hiss from the State Department was John Foster Dulles, who said, would you work for Carnegie Corporation instead? And I began to wonder, was Alger Hiss removed from the State Department because he was too nosy about the rearmament of Germany? Mm. You see, you have two giants here meeting head on, maybe not knowing each other. You see, anyone in Germany who was into the process of rearmament was murdered. And the book that on disarmament that I quoted last week, and I'll quote it almost every week, goes into the fact of 400 political murders and discrediting of people who got wind of the two governments, the secret government and the official army government, that then allowed Hitler to come into power. So in the Versailles Treaty, we had the statement that Germany couldn't rearm. And a man working in our State Department named Alger Hiss, was working on disarmament in 1934 when John Foster Dulles removed him from that position to the Carnegie Corporation. And later, when Alger Hiss was fingered by Richard Nixon as being a communist,
which effectively discredited anything Alger Hiss might have to say thereafter.
Yeah, and Alger Hiss had been to Yalta with Roosevelt, and he held for the UN, and President Truman had been behind him. So this discredited the whole era. If there was one communist, in the movie, Richard Nixon says, if there's one communist at Yalta, it's one too many. If there's one communist at the UN, it's one too many. But in Germany, if they had clandestine armies murdering, reversing the court procedures, switching roles around where the innocent looked guilty and the guilty looked innocent, all this evidence planted, could it have been that Alger Hiss was fingered for a discredit job that would eventually build up Richard Nixon? You see, it could be that when Alger Hiss came to trial, John Foster Dulles would not come to his defense. He appointed him head of Carnegie Corporation, but when he wanted his defense, Dulles would not back up Alger Hiss at all. And John Foster Dulles and Alan Dulles sat with Richard Nixon in the hotel, and Richard Nixon said, what should I do about this case? And the Dulles brothers said, you'd do a disservice to your country if you didn't pursue it.
Now, John Foster Dulles, of course, was Secretary of State. Alan Dulles was head of the CIA, was he not?
Well, John Foster Dulles was running our entire State Department under Eisenhower. He was the Foreign Affairs Advisor under Wilkie and would have been Secretary of State. But he wasn't because Wilkie lost. But his brother, Alan Dulles, was in Germany. And he met at that time with Richard Helm, who also was a newspaper writer, then went into the OSS and became the chief of our CIA later. And Reinhard Gehlen, the chief Nazi who rebuilt Germany after World War II and turned over his entire clandestine army to our CIA, and they joined like blood brothers. These particular gentlemen are active in covert black operation. In fact, Richard Helms wanted to be chief of all covert black CIA operations, and somebody else got the job above him for a while. And if in Germany you could murder many, many people, reverse the courts, plant evidence, why couldn't you in this country do the same to Alger Hiss to make Richard Nixon president? Before we close, I just want to read you, if we have time, from the hardbound book, My Sixth Crisis by Richard Nixon. He says on page 59, only 6 days remained before the grand jury would expire on the investigation of the Hiss case, and a massive search was initiated for the key witness. The key thing in the whole Hiss case that convicted Alger Hiss of perjury was the old Woodstock typewriter on which Chambers said Mrs. Hiss typed the incriminating documents. On December the 13th, FBI agents found the typewriter, and on the same day, I appeared before the grand jury with the microfilm. That's Richard Nixon in 1962. In 1968, Richard Nixon revises the book, and he says,
This is the same book.
He says, only 6 days remained before the grand jury would expire, and the FBI was given the go-ahead to dig out the facts of the case. A massive search was initiated, and the key witness in the case, the old Woodstock typewriter, on which Chambers said Mrs. His had typed the incriminating documents. On December the 13th, FBI agents were unable to find the typewriter, but they did find letters which Ms. Priscilla His said she typed on the Woodstock. Now, Richard Nixon, in 1962, the prime investigator on the case tells you they found the typewriter. In 1968, Richard Nixon tells you they were unable to find the typewriter. This is his research, not mine. This is the case that he says made him president of the United States. Two versions of this. It was pointed to my attention by an assemblyman in Sacramento. I want him to open up the archives and the documents on the killing of Robert Kennedy because he represents the Southwest area. His investigator said to me on the telephone, Richard Nixon is a psychopath. I said, sir, we are the sick ones, not him. We have put him into power. He referred to these two books, told me to look them up. I got both copies, read sentence for sentence. This is what I call fact power. Sat for hours. Nobody else would say he didn't know the sentences till I found the two differences in the most important piece of evidence that incriminated Alger Hiss. And he has two versions himself, like two autopsy reports. Now, this is an insane world, and we have to get our sanity back. What do you do about this problem?
May, something that frightens me, Richard Nixon is a politician. Anyone who goes into politics, I think we can describe as a politician without insulting them, and it's not putting
them
down.
He's a genius, really.
Okay, he's very politically conscious. And yet, at this period in his political history, he has alienated vast, vast segments of the population of the country that would elect him if he is to be reelected. He even has the John Birch Society down on him now because of his trip to China. I can't think of any particular segment of our population that isn't down on Richard Nixon. So it would seem with that kind of situation that it would be highly unlikely that he might be reelected, and yet he seems very serene and very secure and very confident and very strong, and it's as though he was just absolutely assured that everything was going to be all right for him.
He does not appear
to be a man running scared, in other words.
He's absolutely confident, and I know he will be elected unless we occult this madness, because...
Well, who will vote for him?
It doesn't matter. When you don't have choices, then the lesser, you know, the man who gets the most votes wins. The Democratic Party is going to be so split that if Henry Jackson gets in, none of the blacks, Mexican-American youth will vote. So Richard Nixon gets in. All he has to do is be a candidate. If you get McGovern in, he would be killed. He can't get money to run. Fred Harris can't get money to run. The men that would effect changes, the Democratic Party won't give them the money to run. They're bankrupt. In order to get a name that will be able to run against Richard Nixon, what are you going to do? You scrape the barrel. You got 10 men, Yorty, Muskie. It's a disgrace to put this parade of people. Shirley Chisholm is qualified. How is she going to get it? Is the Pentagon going to let her be president?
Hmm.
You know, just ask yourself, could she really get it?
How about Humphrey and McCarthy?
Who wants them? I brought in a little book because there was an article about Eugene McCarthy in the paper this week.
Who's who in the CIA?
Well, yeah, this is a book printed in East Germany, but for all those youthful people who had daisies all over their car at the time of the last election, I said the whole purpose of McCarthy was to play this cat-and-mouse game. I said earlier on the show that Robert Kennedy was going to be a candidate, but Lyndon had to have an excuse very nicely to drop out, and the only reason McCarthy said he was going to run is then Robert Kennedy said, I'll run, and McCarthy backed out.